Ladies and gentlemen, we are having a little delay getting everybody in because we're passing out translation devices at the door. But would everybody who is actually here go ahead and take a seat so we can begin? We've got to start with the commitments so we can get on to the program. We have a very impressive group of people from Latin America. Hi, Frank. But please, everybody sit down so we can begin. And then bring everybody in at the door as quick as you can and give them the translation devices. I would like to now ask the people who are involved in the next commitment to come forward. John Wood, the founder and CEO of Room to Read, and Aaron Ganju, the chief operating officer of Room to Read. Would you please come up? And if I'd like to ask everybody who's here at lunch, I know you want to talk, but please give these people a little respect when we answer these commitments and sit down.
Was great.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Wood is a remarkable man who wrote the story of his own giving in a book entitled Leaving Microsoft to Change the World. And I highly recommend it for those of you who are trying to decide what to do with the rest of your lives. Their commitment is worth $25 million and involves providing greater educational opportunities for children around the world by doubling Room to Read's reach to nearly 3 million children by 2010. Since its inception, Room to Read has reached 1.3 million children through the construction of schools, libraries, and the publication of books in 6 countries. This commitment will expand it into 8 new countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America to affect another 1.5 million children. In 2007, this year, its Reading Room program will open its 5,000th library, and it will open another 5,000 libraries by 2010. This is an astonishing thing. Room to Read is being supported by Scholastic Inc., Goldman Sachs, and Cathay Pacific. John Wood, in his travels as a private citizen, discovered how many school children there were in the world with no books, no libraries, no school buildings. And he has made an astonishing difference, now being helped by Goldman Sachs, Cathay Pacific, and Scholastic Inc., $25 million to give 1.5 million kids in 8 countries a chance to read and learn. Let's give him a big hand. Now I would like to invite to the platform Mark Buell, Susie Tompkins Buell, Kathy Zoer, the CEO of the Alliance for Climate Protection. Mark, are you here? There you are. Susie, come on. There you go. The Buells and the Alliance for Climate Protection are supporting. The Buells are supporting the Alliance for Climate Protection to educate people about the necessity of adopting and implementing solutions for the climate crisis. The commitment is for $5 million over the next 3 years. The Alliance for Climate Protection was founded and chaired by Al Gore, and it is designed to keep moving our climate change efforts forward. The Buells' commitment will allow the Alliance to build on the success it's already had in creating support for our leadership rather than our followership in international efforts to solve the climate crisis. It will help the Alliance to persuade individuals to achieve carbon neutrality. This is very important. The more and more people who can do this, the more we will believe that the nation and the world can do it. So thank you very much, Mark and Susie. Thank you, Kathy, for the work of the Alliance. Let's give them all a big hand. The next commitment is fascinating to me. I'd like to invite Peter Diamandis, the founder and CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation, Larry Page, the co-founder of Google, and Arianna Huffington up here. This commitment involves the XPRIZE Vision Circle members, the Templeton Foundation, the Kauffman Foundation, Prize Capital, the Global Environmental Facility, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Google. And I can't wait to tell you about it. I don't know how many of you know about the XPRIZE, but several years ago, the first time I ever heard about them was when they offered a $10 million prize to figure out how to take an ordinary citizen into space at some reasonably affordable price. I wanted them to do it, I just didn't want to be one of them. This commitment is to create breakthroughs in energy and climate change, education, health, and poverty alleviation by conducting 12 global competitions for large prizes. And the commitment is for $300 million for 12 prizes in the areas of energy and climate change, education, health, and poverty alleviation. Each of the 12 prizes will be highly visible competitions to encourage revolutionary advances. They are expected to produce $5 billion in investments by people competing for these prizes, and at least 10 times that much in public and private expenditures. The most famous of these prizes has already been publicized. They have offered a massive prize to anyone who can develop a commercially viable automobile that can get 100 miles a gallon, right? So, but think of this, 12 prizes in areas designed to break barriers to human health, have children live longer, solve all these education problems, how to do it in the most cost-effective way. This is the most amazing idea to me, trying to unleash entrepreneurship in the public interest. And there's money behind this, $300 million. So for all those who contributed and to all those who are up on this stage, I thank you. Thank you, Arianna Huffington. Thank you, Larry Page. And thank you, Peter Diamandis. This XPRIZE, I hope I live long enough to see all of them granted. Let's give them a big hand. Thank you. Now, I'd like to invite to the stage perhaps the most famous person to be on this stage today, and appropriate for our Latin American plenary, I'd like to invite Shakira up here and the Alice Foundation. I think they're here. I was told they were. There she is. Come on. I want to commend Shakira for her lifelong commitment to advocating for social change in education. She has created schools for displaced youth in her native Colombia, is an active partner with the Alice Foundation as they work to improve health and education for all children in Latin America. The unique collaboration of Latin artists, intellectual, and entrepreneurs make Alice an ideal institution to build a culture of philanthropy throughout Central and South America, something I have been privileged to support over the last few years. Today, she makes two commitments. First, ALOS, with partners with the Pan American Development Foundation, the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, and the Spanish Agency for International Cooperation, commits to educating millions of Latin American parents about the importance of early childhood development through a public awareness campaign, with an innovative $5 million pilot program in four countries to provide integrated services in education, early stimulation, nutrition, and health. Second, ALOS, with partners including the Ledre Pajin of the Spanish Agency of International Cooperation, over 35 artists and business leaders that represent ALOS, including Carlos Slim and Cesar Alerta, the Red Cross, all of them commit to reducing the effects of natural disasters in Peru and Nicaragua through the direct investment into the reconstruction of education, sanitation, and water systems, and in Peru through a multimedia fundraising campaign featuring top Latin artists. Ameliorating the effects of these natural disasters, as those of us who are now still living through the aftermath of Katrina know, is a profoundly important thing to do. And this commitment of hers and the ALOS Foundation is valued at more than $40 million. So thank you, Shakira. Thank you, ALOS. Thank you very much. Now we're going to have a fascinating plenary on Latin America, and it's worked out just about great. Almost everybody is in. Thank you very much, and thanks again for the people who made the commitments.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. President of the Inter-American Development Bank, Luis Alberto Moreno. President of the Argentine Republic, Nestor Carlos Kirchner. Chairman of the Board of Grupo Carso, Carlos Slim Ilu. President of the Dominican Republic, Leonel Fernandez. And our moderator, editor of Newsweek International, Fareed Zakaria.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming to this session. Usually at these kinds of things, one often says, we are all that stands between you and lunch. But in this case, it's not true. You get to eat while we talk. So we will try to make your lunch as enjoyable as possible. When I initially heard about the list of people who were going to be at this very distinguished panel, I thought I understood the theme of this panel perfectly. President Kirchner of Argentina, as you probably know, is going to leave office. The candidate most likely to succeed him as head of state is his wife. And so I assumed that we were going to have an intimate conversation between the two potential members of the smallest club in the world, former heads of state who will be the spouses of heads of state, a group that will, by the end of next year, probably be two members. But I was then told that we're going to talk about globalization. So for those of you who have questions on the way in which to best perform as a first husband or first gentleman, you're going to have to ask those questions privately. What I thought we would do is to try to talk about this in the spirit of the Clinton Global Initiative, which is to not simply have a wide-ranging and interesting discussion about the topic, but to really ask what we can do to solve one of the fundamental problems that the initiative tries to take on. And so I'm going to start out by posing a question that I hope will be one we'll try and get an answer to in some way or the other as we go forward. And the question is this: how do you make economic reform and policies that are pro-growth work in the context of political democracy? In other words, I think there is something of a consensus around the world, particularly among people who are, you know, smart and technocratically able and understand economics, as to what to do in countries, where the inefficiencies are, how do you produce growth. The question is, how do you sell that? How do you make it politically viable? How do you make it politically palatable? And I think what we have a unique opportunity here with two heads of state, one of the richest men in the world, if not the richest man in the world, and an extraordinarily intelligent and capable head of the OAS, to tell us what it is that we have to do to make this a sustainable and systematic move forward, not dependent on one good president here or there. So let me start by asking Luis Alberto to just sketch the scene for us in Latin America. It seems like in a 20-year time frame, Latin America is doing fantastically. It's gone from dictatorship to democracy, stagnation to growth. But in a 2-year time span, the pressures of globalization are now encroaching on Latin America. It faces competition from China. Every one of these countries is asking itself, how do you move up the value chain? And it has to do this all in the context of a very populist democratic politics that has emerged.
Well, thank you, Farid. Of course, that question, I'm sure President Kirchner and President Fernandez can answer better in terms of the politics. But let me just put into context the following. Look at Latin America over the last 30 years. We had roughly about 50% of the population lived in rural areas. Today, that situation is 75% of Latin America's population live in cities. What does that mean? Well, of course, tremendous pressures around cities and tremendous pressures around local governments, and certainly with implications on climate change issues. The other part is that the pressures on globalization, I don't think, are unique only to Latin America. They're unique to all governments in the emerging economies. What you do see in Latin America today is the success of people like Carlos Slim and others who are creating increasingly global companies that are advancing at a tremendous rate. For instance, here in New York, in the New York Stock Exchange, Latin American companies trade about $2 billion a day. And increasingly, you find more and more companies coming and being listed. So what has happened? I think the main issue that has happened in Latin America is that there is macroeconomic stability. And people really value macroeconomic stability in Latin America today. Low inflation, growth that is coming largely from current account surpluses. And I think Latin America is moving to a new moment, and a moment that I think one has to be very optimistic. And where the challenges are going to be are certainly about many of the issues that are discussed here around health, around education, especially education for quality jobs, because these are the jobs that are going to be needed for companies like those of Carlos to continue to grow.
Let me ask you, President Fernandez, you have been able to work wonders in the Dominican Republic. You have now, I think, a 10% growth rate this year. This is Chinese-style growth. How do you do economic reform in a democracy?
Well, that's a good question, but it's also a tough question, because it will depend on the circumstances. If you come into office within an economic and financial crisis, as we did in 2004, it is easier to convince the population that can implement a reform process. Now, you have to look perhaps at three main issues by trying to implement economic reform. This program has to be economically sound. You have to overcome the crisis that you have inherited from your predecessor. But at the same time, it has to be politically viable. That means that it needs to have political support. and that you will have to work on building consensus among the different groups around the country in order to have the political support you will need in order to implement these economic reforms. And thirdly, I think it needs to have a social impact. People need to feel that these reforms will improve the quality of their lives. So you need to bring all these three factors, all these three issues together.
Do you do the social impact by having programs that are essentially redistributive, or do you mean you need to communicate in a way that makes it easier for people to understand that growth helps them?
I think you need to do both things. You need to have a strategy of communication where people can feel that the reforms that are going to be implemented will have an impact in their lives, and you will have to design and implement specific social programs that you can monitor, that you can assess periodically, and that you can evaluate that it is truly having this sort of impact. If you do not bring together all these three issues, the most likely is that your program will fail, because people will not feel the importance it has in uplifting their quality of life. You will lose political support. The media will start putting headlines that will be negative to your programs. And then you'll lose steam, and at the end you'll have street protests, and the whole economic program can go out of hand.
President Kushner, you have pursued a somewhat unorthodox strategy in that you didn't listen to conventional economic wisdom on some of these issues, and you have pursued a policy that some people will call quite populist. You have many subsidies, price controls, beef is controlled in Argentina, because of course in Argentina controlling beef is probably a crucial element of keeping the population happy. Do you think that this is a sustainable model? Do you think you found a new path, quite different from the Washington consensus?
Mainly the IMF, in the case of our region, had devastating effects. All adjustment policies, the currency board, which pegged the peso one-to-one to the dollar, the orthodox financial policies, led to an unprecedented social explosion in Argentina, with 60% people in poverty, 27% extreme poverty, a very strong immigration policy towards other countries, with Argentina having been the eighth largest economy in the world in the early part of the century. The devaluation was also unprecedented, and all institutional, social, political, and economic structures collapsed. We don't have price control policies. Actually, what we do is price monitoring, and we do, of course, have policies aimed at supporting investments, mainly within the framework of transportation infrastructure policies, which, due to the privatization process which took place in Argentina in a very unfair way in the 90s, currently forces the state to engage in a promotional policy to provide support. We don't actually give subsidies for the sake of just doing it. What we have managed to do is bring reserves from $6 billion to $43 billion using this supposedly unorthodox approach. We have brought poverty down from 60% to 23.4%, extreme poverty from 27% to 8.2%. We got unemployment down from 30 to 8.5%, and we've also succeeded in getting fixed gross investment to amount to 168% more than in 2002. At the height of the crisis in Argentina, we sold 90,000 cars a year. This year, in August, we sold 53,000, and we expect to have sold 540,000 for the whole year. And we have three key pillars in our economy. Solvency through our reserves, primary fiscal surplus, something which the orthodox advocates didn't actually look after. Well, the U.S. right now, following orthodox policies, has a large deficit, and we, supposedly unorthodox, have primary fiscal surplus in addition to our trade surplus. We have twin surpluses, in other words, which ensures a sound economy with controlled monetary issue and with a major investment policy which is helping Argentina grow at unprecedented rates. To give you the picture of it, we are growing at an average 8.5% a year. It's the first time in 100 years that Argentina has grown for five consecutive years at these rates. And next year, when Cristina is in office, we will continue to grow, and it will be the first time in our country's history that we will have grown for six consecutive years. Just to give an idea, Argentina used to export $26 billion in 2002. And by the end of the year, the figure will be $52 billion in exports. And very importantly, these exports are no longer focused only on commodities, but between 42 and 48% of our exports are now manufacturers of industrial origin. So it depends on your perspective, how you analyze the concept of orthodox and unorthodox. I think you need to be realistic 100% and pursue the policies required by each individual situation. Argentina is also engaging in a major debt reduction policy. We have paid off our whole debt to the IMF, which enables us to deal with our matters on our own. We have renegotiated our private external debt satisfactorily, bringing about a major debt reduction. And we're joined by the IDB president, and the World Bank president knows that Argentina has reduced its debt to these bodies between 30 and 40% on average. These are key factors. And under orthodox policies, Argentina ended up having 14 different currencies. In theory, to support the currency board and the one-to-one exchange rate and to sustain the fiscal balances, which continue to generate further debt. I think one needs to consider that there is no absolute truth in this field, and we need to draw on different perspectives in order to find the ultimate recipe for us. So here in this dear country, the U.S., let me say that orthodox policies have led to a major deficit. And although we are supposed to be unorthodox, we have twin surpluses, both trade and fiscal surplus. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. There are some people who might quibble with the idea of current administration policies as being orthodox in any fashion fiscally. But one absolute truth about development, I think, is that the private sector has to be the leading player. And Carlos Slim Hilu is at the center of an extraordinary revolution that has taken place in Latin America, where in countries like Mexico and Brazil, whether or not the governments are reforming, these companies are becoming more and more efficient. And in the process, of course, you have built one of the great, great global business empires. Tell us a little bit about what made Latin America's private sector change, and do you think that this is a process that can go on whether or not the government continues to reform?
Thank you. Well, I will try to speak in English. I will make an effort to be clear. Well, I think first of all, we need to understand what is happening and what will happen in the future. And it's very clear already that we are living a new civilization with new paradigms. And these paradigms is democracy, liberty, freedom, diversity, plurality, human rights, environment, globalization is only one paradigm, globalization, competition, and knowledge, technology, innovation, etc. So we are living this new society. And every country needs to find how to get involved in this new civilization. And I think what President Kirchner said was very clear. To be in the reality of the things, what is happening, what are the conditions. That's why China is doing it very well, because they are looking which is the best way to get involved in this new civilization. But by exports, they are very global. By imports, they are not so global. But they are working too much in knowledge, in education, and getting out of poverty a lot of people with a relatively close economy for many things. And they are getting people out of poverty by education and by jobs. The only way to fight poverty, I think, is by health, education, jobs, economic activity. Economic activity is the only way to create a middle class. You need to have large middle classes to develop your country, to develop the society. And I think that in Latin America, after the different crises we have in the past, in the recent past, like 95 in Mexico, the crisis in Brazil, in Argentina, in Dominican Republic, and others, and some others, we are making now better. We are having a different situation in each country, but all the countries are clear that we need to grow, that we need to combine public investment and private investment to leverage our possibilities of development. And it's clear that the only way to go ahead is by investment. Investment should be bigger to grow more and to have the possibility of jobs. And with better education, you have better jobs. And I think all the countries in Latin America, most of the countries in Latin America are pushing investment. Public investment in some ways, taking care of current expenses, private national investment, and private foreign investment. And I think, the health of the economies in Latin America is very sound, is very good. Like President Kirchner said, they have a superávit. The efforts of President Fernandez in Dominican Republic to change the situation that was not in health conditions has been very important, and that has been a very important way to do that. Our operation in Latin America in mobile that has been developed, we have grown 66% in the last 15 years, every year. And why have we done? Well, first, because they were a demand of the services, and we can find how to segment the market to make it available to most of the population. And we have countries like Nicaragua with 3% penetration that now has 40-something, higher than China. Or Argentina, that when we get make our investment 4.5 years ago, the penetration was lower than 20, and now it's 90, higher than U.S. penetration. Chile. And this year we will have 2 of every 3 Latin Americans with a mobile. Still,
most of them owned by you.
No, like 40%, 35. 3 years ago, I will tell that in Mexico we were second in the market. We were not first in the market. Now we are the leaders. In Latin America we are leaders in some countries. We are second in others. We are third in others. And we are just getting in other places. Like in Chile, we are just beginning with 15% market share.
So what you're describing is a kind of a strange shift where you are having a move to the industrial but also the post-industrial economy simultaneously, and a move in a sense from the village to the city, but then out beyond, all happening at the same time.
Well, I should say that we need to look this history 200 years ago. In U.S., in the middle of the 19th century, 75-80% of the population were peasants and rural. The development to get industrial and urban is a good thing for economy. I don't see that kind of things like problems. They are opportunities. And all the developed countries get developed because they grow by moving from one agricultural economy to an industrial economy. China is growing because they are coming from a very old agricultural economy, rural area, to a very developed new civilization passing by a very efficient industrial civilization. That's what they are doing. What technology do is to improve productivity in every camp, in every field, in every activity. And when you improve productivity in every activity, that means that you need less people doing this production, and they can be involved in other areas. That's what agricultural civilization is primary, the other is secondary, and now we are in an economy of services. Most population is in services. Because production is very easy to do, because the machines do that, very efficient, very fast, very wide. And that's very important, because in indigenous civilization, the creation of wealth is very easy. It's more easy than ever before. And that's what is important, because this new civilization is founded in the welfare of the others. Yeah. That's why we don't have slaves. That's why we don't have, there are no colonies. That what many things. Now you need market development. You need economy development. That's why investment to get out of margination to the people is the best thing for everyone.
President Fernandez, so when you see this process of wrenching economic change that is taking place faster than has ever happened, I mean, it's important to keep in mind that, you know, when the U.S. industrialized, it grew at about 3% a year in the late 19th century. China is growing at 11% a year. You are growing at those kinds of rates. So you have a huge change. There have got to be losers. What do you do with the losers? I mean, this is a question that we ask in the United States, but it must be even more pressing in a country which has fewer resources to tackle.
Well, absolutely. And from your previous intervention, you brought up the metaphor about people moving forward and others being left out. And I think this is part of the problem we're facing in Latin America today. Part of our population is living within the 21st century. With all the comfort, with all the technologies. But another important segment of the population is still in the 19th century. So our main challenge is, how can we bring all this together? And how can we have a policy that can be inclusive, that all the population take advantage of the modernization process and of our integration within the global economy? I think this is the main challenge. And we see it because some polls that have been taken in the region by very prestigious firms like Latino Barometro, for example, we can see already that there's some sort of disappointment with democracy in Latin America. And when you look where is this disappointment coming from, it is not on the workings of the institutions, because we have been able to guarantee over the last 30 years the protection for human rights and human dignity. There's more transparency. There's more anti-corruption policies in our countries. There's more accountability. So the disappointment, it has to do more with what people consider is a lack of performance, a lack of deliverance in terms of economic and social results. So what people are demanding in our countries is more jobs, like Carlos Slim just said, access to quality education, access to health care, to housing, to water supply, sanitation, power electric system, those basic core things that people need in order to live in a civilized world. Now, in Latin America, we have not been able historically, up to this point, to perform in such a way that we can meet those demands from the population. So it is still a pending challenge to all of us. How can we solve that? I think the only way through is by integrating ourselves into the global economy. For a country like the Dominican Republic, the implementation of DRCAFTA represents a great opportunity. It's having permanent access to the most important market in the world on a duty-free basis. But having access is not enough, so we also have to do our own homework back in the Dominican Republic. And this means that we need to design and implement a national strategy for development and competitiveness. And when we talk about development and competitiveness, I think three points come to the fore. One has to do, how do you increase production? How do you improve productivity? That means also technology transfer and the training of your workforce. So we go back to education. And in that case, what we're trying to do is to promote a new curricula in the Dominican Republic where all the children and our students can have access to information and communications technologies, and also the learning of English as a second language. So with these two tools, I think we have a new generation of Dominicans coming out of our educational system that will have the capacity to take advantage of the new opportunities created by this globalized world. So for us, education is key. We also are having, for example, a scholarship program funded by the Dominican government. Right now we have 3,000 Dominican students abroad.
And by the next 5 years, we hope to have 10,000 Dominicans studying here at U.S. colleges in Europe, in other countries in Latin America, in Asia, so that when they come back to our country, they will have a different mindset, a sense of modernization, a commitment to their country, and make a better life for all in the Dominican Republic. It's not an easy task. As I said, how can you proceed with a modernizing process that can be inclusive? I think this is our main challenge, but it can only be obtained, as I said, by breaking away from isolationism, by opening up your economy, increasing productivity, and as I said before, by at the same time simultaneously having a social program that can have an impact on people's daily lives.
President Kirchner. When you look at this issue of opening up to the world, historically when Latin America has thought about opening up to the world, it has meant really opening up to the north, to the United States. Do you think that Latin America is now going to open up more aggressively to the non-American world, the rising powers in Asia, Europe, with which you have historic links? Where do you see the future of Latin America's relations being? Is America still the biggest game? Is the United States still the biggest game in town? Or are you looking at other countries as well?
I like to be quite frank. In Latin America, in South America, we are building Mercosur, in which we are conducting a major integration process, and we are trying to build a space with all South American, Latin American countries, and we also hope to be able to make a very important country and economy join in, and I'm speaking of Mexico, so as to become common partners sharing common interests. The fact is that in recent years, at least that is my view of the situation from Argentina, I would say that the crisis we had in 2001 and 2002, if we had found a different response on the part of the U.S. government, the problems wouldn't have got as serious in Argentina as they unfortunately did. I took office sometime after that, but I talked about this with President Clinton yesterday, and we did agree on this, although we may have differences in other respects. For example, when Senator Kirchner asked President Clinton how he would support his wife, he said he would do whatever he was told. So I disagree on that. So I think I will take a different approach. But he seems to be ready to submit.
Well, women's lib has not reached Latin America in quite the same way.
La liberación. Honestly now and seriously, I believe the U.S. should pay more attention to Latin America. Wherever I go, I always get asked questions about a friend of Argentina, President Chavez. Look at what an issue I brought up now. But I think it's important to deal with that. I believe the whole region, all of the Latin American region, if it is better understood by the U.S. and if we manage to have a better block-to-block dialogue, and the same with the EU and Asia, I think relations will be different. But I think our region has been somewhat forgotten. And when I'm asked why we have such relations, I always say that President Chavez is a good friend of Argentina. And in fact, I always say, and I said this to Mr. Tom Shannon, we don't actually finance the Bolivarian revolution, but rather the U.S., which sells $43 billion and also buys a large amount from Venezuela. What I would like to request the U.S. is to come a lot closer to our region. That would be very important. It is a country that we are very fond of, we have a lot of appreciation for, and my friend Carlos Tim knows what investment in the region can bring. He has sold something like $4.4 billion in the region. Isn't that so? And the region has developed very favorable. It has become a major business center, and we want to attract as much capital as possible. So what we need to have is a block-to-block relationship, the Latin American region with the U.S. and the Americas with the EU and with Asia as well. We need agreements that are equitable, balanced, and fair. And besides, I think education is key to fight against poverty and to have social inclusion with equity. And we need to take specific steps. We will be allocating 6% of our budget in Argentina from now to 2010 to investment in education, better pay for teachers, research, to have better people in government as well in the future. And we are favoring equal opportunity. And I think social plans are okay, support programs are okay, but it is essential to have full employment and decent employment, which is what people deserve. We think that social programs and support programs can be good at certain points in time, but you need to have policies that are inclusive in order to build a society that is quite different. And human resources are key. If you come to Argentina, take a look at our country, or see Argentines working abroad, you'll see that for very many years, our human resources have excelled in terms of their quality. The thing is that we Argentines have suffered blows as a result of poverty. So we went from self-esteem to no self-esteem. And sometimes when things are going rather roughly for us, we think we are the worst in the world. And when things are more or less okay, we think we are the best in the world. So we need to strike a balance and to recover our own self-esteem. I would say that a block-to-block dialogue is very important. I think we need to speak in all sincerity. And let me tell you, in the last few years, we didn't feel that we were getting the support of the United States. Of course, it would be nice to say that the U.S. has always been with us. And actually, we had differences with regard to FTAA or integration policies. We've had different views with regard to solutions to certain issues around the world. But all our efforts, and we hope that will be the case with future U.S. administrations as well, our efforts are aimed at finding agreements and convergence throughout the region. I think that's very important for all of our continent. We also think that we as a region need to advance further, make progress, become more skilled, more trained, and many problems we have to deal with ourselves. And this is what the different countries in the region are doing. An interesting evolution is going on, and it's interesting to look at the poverty reduction figures, at the investment increases and so on. An example in my country, industry has grown 9.8% in Argentina year on year. It is important to encourage that and to include value added in basic production. 50 years ago, Argentina only exported primary products. You know, a crisis in international prices could have actually disrupted the economy. It is not the case anymore because we are diversifying our exports. Therefore, we are optimistic and we look optimistically to the future, and we certainly hope to once again come closer to the U.S. as part of a joint work and enterprise. And it is important to get, not help, that's not what we're asking for, but the possibility of working together to build a better society, which we're sure is what most of our sister nations here aspire to.
Carlos Slim, let me ask you how you approach this question of change and winners and losers. Latin America has historically been a place of great inequalities of wealth. Mexico and Brazil in particular, you are now, by some rankings, the richest man in the world. I haven't looked this up, but I'm going to guess that your personal net worth is larger than the GDP of the Dominican Republic. So In that context, what do you think the private sector's responsibility is in both charitable terms, but also in terms of the image and the communication that it presents?
Well, I don't know, but be sure that when I pass away, I don't will take anything with me. Well, I agree in many things about what President Kirchner has said. I believe that we are very complementary with U.S. I think U.S. has not seen for their interest to Latin America because we are 500 million, more than 500 million of inhabitants that are not only a very good investment, and I give a test of that, but also a very big market, a very interesting market. And what I had seen in U.S. doing is to change goods for assets. You are buying a lot of goods and giving a lot of assets, including treasury bills, or mostly treasury bills, no? And that's not, I think, a smart thing to do. And I look at the investments of U.S. not very active in Latin America. The main business or activities, I look American companies out of Latin America, excepting maybe the traditionals. Like I was talking, we were growing 65% or 67% in the last 15 years. And from 95 to today, in 12 years, we grew 300 times the size of number, the number of subscribers. In Argentina, particularly, we get being the fourth competitor. We were four companies. We were the fourth one. And we grow 10 times we will grow 10 times in 5 years. And, well, that's something that is very important for American companies to invest. I think it's not an issue of taxpayers' problem. Is to invest profitable in Latin America. And I will be sure that with this complement that we have with Latin America, we will sell a lot of things to U.S., but also buy a lot of things to U.S. More, and the investment of the American companies can be very, very interesting to do business in Latin America, and we are looking foreign companies, not American companies, not U.S. companies investing in Latin America. I think that the opening is already on the way that every time we need to integrate first regionally and growing our opening all around. But when we talk about globalization and opening, we should not talk only about capital and finance or trade. We need to talk also about labor. Because you cannot open only trade and finance and close labor, no? You need to make some agreements in every of these fields. I think that in the future we will open every time more, integrated every time more, first by regions, first some groups of countries, and at the end of the day will be a worldwide opening world and integrated in many areas. And I think it's not of winners and losers. It's it can be a winner-winner. You need the best investment is fight poverty, because you take out from margination and you get them involved in modernity and the market and in the economy.
As a Mexican, how have you reacted to the debate about immigration reform in the United States over the last year?
I don't understand. I don't understand the wall. That's crazy. I don't understand. To talk about security and having 50 million illegals, I think it should be something organized. I think we need to give jobs in our countries to the people. That's why we need to invest more and educate better. We need to give jobs in our country. But there are some jobs that can come legally by agreements for the interest of people, but mainly for the interest of both countries.
Luisa,
all countries, all the countries, not only Mexico and U.S., all the countries of Latin America. No?
Luis Alberto, talk to this issue of America's relationship with Latin America. I mean, you have an unusual position in that you have to represent, I suppose, all all of Latin America in your position as the head of the Inter-American Bank, but do you think that the United States is correct in turning some Latin American country like Venezuela into a pariah state, into a problem case, and asking other Latin American countries to enlist on its side in this venture? How do you think we should be approaching the problem of what appears to be a rising tide of anti-Americanism and populism in some parts of Latin America? And they are often small parts, but quite spirited anti-Americanism. I mean, we have many problems with us, but, you know, when a head of state comes to the United Nations and says that, you know, he can smell Satan or whatever it was he said after Bush, that is also itself a problem.
Look, I think you got to begin to understand that Latin America is very different today than it used to be before. This is not a Latin America that you read from headlines, but a Latin America that you have to understand through its trend lines to many of the things that have been spoken here. And there's a great possibility of constructing a positive agenda with Latin America. And it begins by recognizing that mobility of labor, mobility of trade, mobility of investment are at the core of globalization. And Latin America cannot be excluded of this. And therefore, issues of trade and issues of immigration are at the center of what needs to happen in a better way between the U.S. and Latin America. But then there is, I believe, another huge amount of potential in other areas. In today's world, we are in a situation where the combination of a number of factors such as high oil prices, the so-called unreliability of oil, and more importantly, a groundswell support and recognition by everybody in the world that climate change matters, that green energy is a huge potential. And over the last 50 years of the many industrial revolutions that have taken place, this one is happening at the center of what goes on in Latin America. Today, 40% of biofuels are produced in Latin America. And energy will continue to be a huge issue. Of course, every country will do it differently because it depends on its natural endowments. But you can have, like Argentina has, tremendous possibilities on biodiesel, or the possibilities that the Dominican Republic has around ethanol based on sugarcane. And then I asked myself, and yet the U.S. wants to produce ethanol with corn, which is the most inefficient way of doing it. And by the way, if you were to plant it in Argentina, they would have to pay a tax coming into the United States of about 50 cents and another 50 cents or 54 cents of a subsidy. So that means an Argentinian farmer would have to be, before he ever exported 1 gallon of ethanol, he already would be paying a tremendous penalty. These are the kinds of things that require of a mature relationship. And by talking to everybody and understanding each other in the differences, because governments will always differ. And I think what you are seeing today in Latin America is a maturing of our democracies. And as democracies mature, you know, the policy process becomes much more difficult, as President Fernandez was outlining before. And I think that's really the recognition that Latin America, at the end of the day, no matter what indicator you look at, any doing business indicator, Latin American countries are by far better than many of the Asian countries. So what you have here is a huge opportunity, an opportunity that Latin America is not looking to the U.S. to tell it what to do, and that's very different. This is a Latin America that is starting to be very confident of itself with businessmen like Carlos and others, but more importantly, with everybody. This is a Latin America where it has Shakiras. This is a Latin America that has a huge growth in all its culture. And it's a culture that's having an impact in the States as well. And if you begin to understand the relationship of Latin America with the United States on that basis, then we can have a partnership of prosperity that everybody wishes.
You know,
I think this might be an interesting note to end on, because this panel has been such a vivid demonstration of this new Latin America, you know, of a Latin America that is politically competent, economically sophisticated, whether at the private sector level or the public sector level. And as a result of it, there is an enormous sense of pride in each of these countries, of national confidence, of which, and it is something I do think that the United States has not really noticed is happening, not just in Latin America, but around the world. You know, the natives have gotten very good at capitalism. And all of a sudden, we are sitting here and looking, and when you listen to these people talking about the world, about opening up, about competing with everybody, about moving up the value chain, about plugging in to the rest of the world, and then you listen to the debate taking place on the campaign trail or in Washington, and it's about protection, walls, subsidies, security checks, lines, visa blockage. One of the great problems we are going to face in the 21st century, I believe, is that just as the rest of the world is opening up, we are beginning to close down. And it is going to be a huge problem for us. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. Your working sessions will begin at 2 p.m. Please proceed to your next session. Thank you.